If you do not find a way to tell your own story, someone else will tell it for you, and you won't like it. It could be your parents. It could be your spouse. It could be your boss. Culture will jump into that vacuum. So find a way in words and stories and mosaics, in a quilt, whatever it takes. Learn to seize, it's kind of to seize the day, but it's seize the story.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am so excited to share with you our guest today. His name is Phil Cousineau, and he is the author of over 40 books, including the best-selling The Art of Pilgrimage and The Hero's Journey, Joseph Campbell on His Life and Work. Cousineau is a writer, teacher, filmmaker, storyteller, and cultural historian who has consulted on mythology and story for major studios, including Warner Brothers, Pixar, and Lucasfilm. He's led mythology travel programs to Greece for more than 3 decades, and he has been featured on NPR, CNN International, the BBC, Smithsonian, Discovery Channels, and countless others. He is here with us today to discuss his newest book, The Wisdom of the Odyssey, 24 Life Lessons from Homer's Epic, which is available everywhere today. Phil, welcome to the Daily Helping. I am so excited you're with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's quite a buzz, isn't it, around the movie and the book. It's wonderful to be in that overlap between the two.
So what I usually do, and I can't wait to dive into this because there's so many different things we can talk about, but what I love to do is jump into your time machine. I want to know what puts you on the path that you're on today.
Let's begin here. I was raised in the Midwest, 1950s. We had a 6-foot-tall black and white Zenith television. I was watching the Tigers play in Detroit, and suddenly the television goes on the Fritz. Do you remember that old expression, the Fritz? Oh, the bulbs inside were buzzing and so on. My father spent a few minutes to try to fix the TV and then said, "Help me drag this out." We dragged it through the living room, the kitchen, to the foot of the stairs, and he kicked the TV down the stairs into the basement. And then he turns around and says, "And now we're going to read together out loud as a family." And that night, we began reading the YA, the youth adult version of the Odyssey. I was 10 years old, and I'm in a room now in the living room, and my dad begins reading the Homer. And then my mom takes a page, the three kids, we all take a page. And I became infatuated with the Odyssey right then and there. We went on over the next few years to read Grimm's Fairy Tales, Huckleberry Finn, a little bit of Moby Dick, the youth version. What the point there is, we were reading and these stories got into my bloodstream. And I've been following the mythic movies. I studied some myth in college, the University of Detroit. But then in the mid-1970s, I got a chance to go, and I was living in Europe for a few years, went to Greece, and the first night in Athens, there was a small revolution. And I couldn't get to my hotel, so I walked up the winding path to the Acropolis, and I slept in the Parthenon that night, inside. There were no fences, no guard dogs, nothing to keep me from being there. So you combine the two. The visual, I'm reading, but then I get to go and spend a long time, many, many months in Greece, following in the footsteps of Homer and the classics. It's a great pedagogy. I begin with the love of the word. And then I've spent years, most of my adult life, going to the sites I've read about to get the inside and the outside, what I sometimes call the overstory, which is what happens on the outside, the plot, the narrative of the world. but my life has been devoted to the understory, which is where myth, folklore, poetry, depth psychology is. And somehow, as my father recommended when I left Detroit to come out here to California, he said, go out there and do something no one else can do. What a wonderful thing to hear from your parents, from a mentor. And what that turned out to be is being a commentator on what the story is behind the story, behind the story. So I'm a movie consultant in the movie studios, but I lead tours really all around the world to many, many countries. And I'm looking, as artists do, as poets do, as filmmakers do, what is the deep story? What's the story in the soul and in the spirit? And somehow I found that there is a deep longing in the human race to go a little bit deeper.
It's one thing to have a deep passion for mythology, for history, travel the sites, do the things that you did. It's another thing altogether to become a studio consultant and an expert on mythology for these movies. How did that happen?
The hook for me was in the early 1980s. I was in a little cafe on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, across the street from the famous pharmacy where Lana Turner was discovered. And I was there with some buddies, and we were talking about this recent movie that had come out called Apocalypse Now. Remember the Francis Ford Coppola movie that begins as a movie about Vietnam, but in the end becomes an all-encompassing, very ambitious story about war itself. Why does war horrify us, but also on some insidious level that is part of the allure of the Odyssey, it also enchants us. There was glamour about this. So I'm sitting around talking with my buddies because I've been reading Joseph Campbell, and I've been studying that what are the depths in the movies and in psychology and so on. And lo and behold, there's a fellow behind us who kind of leans back on his chair and says, do you mind if I join in? This is fascinating to find out that there are myths behind our movies. So we said, of course, join us. Within a few minutes, we found out he was booking lectures and workshops for the American Film Institute just a few blocks away. And he said, can you come in public and talk about this? What are the stories behind the story? Within a week, it was flabbergasting how quickly this happened. I was lecturing at the Louis B. Mayer Theater in Hollywood on the myths behind the myths, starting with Apocalypse Now. So very simple, but accessible, but thrilling association. Coppola and his screenwriters, they based Apocalypse Now, the archetypal movie about war, the journey into the heart of darkness, on Joseph Conrad's book, Heart of Darkness, which in turn is based on the Odyssey. So here is a kind of jack-in-the-box, a movie based on a novel, which is based on a myth, an old Greek myth. I then, as I, for the next few years, I began doing this with every possible movie, film noir, The Wizard of Oz, for example, as a modern American fairy tale. And what I've discovered with aspiring screenwriters, but also the public, coming all the way up into the present, people who want to know what's the mythology behind Wonder Woman, Superman, Batman, is there a story there? It helps us feel less alone in the world to know someone was there before us. So I have been braced and encouraged for years by this wondrous, not just a loose quote, but it was this passage from James Baldwin, comes from a 1963 interview in Life magazine, where the reporter just asks Baldwin, a very esteemed African-American writer, gorgeous novelist, why books? Why stories? Why do we care? And Baldwin says something that takes my breath away. And this is a very close, paraphrase, very close to the exact quote. It says, just when you think your heartbreak and your pain is unprecedented in the history of the world, comma, one of the great commas of all time, then you read. Isn't that, that's stunning, because so many people, if they're not reading, this is a big problem with teenagers, by the way, in the suicide epidemic. If you don't read, you don't know the stories that have come before you. You don't know that other people have had epiphanies, but also deep, deep heartbreak. So what that leads us to then is something that I learned a lot working with Campbell for 8 years. With all these myths, fairy tales, folklores, fables out there, you read until you find something with which you identify. You find yourself in a Grimm's fairy tale. You find yourself in a movie from the 1920s or a Sam Shepard play. It is a wondrous thing to know you are part of the human race. And in that spirit, the Odyssey has been popular for 3,000 years. Why would it appeal? How can it appeal? Across time, but across place, there is no culture that I know of anyway around the world that has not had a version of the Odyssey. They retell it in their own way, or they make mosaics, murals, paintings about it, nowadays movies. What is it? What is it in the Odyssey that makes people want to study it, read it, do their own versions of it? One theme is that it's about a hero in the aftermath of a war, a savage war, 10 years of fighting, who is trying to get home again. That metaphor is both literal, here, this is a warrior trying to go home after a war to get reunite with his family, his wife, his son, and so on. But it's also psychologically a figurative statement in the sense of we are sometimes lost. We lose our way. What's our true home, our true self? We lose our way. We are seduced by money, power, glamour. The Odyssey is a story about the dangers of seduction by monsters, by war, the glamour of war, and by the nymphs that are along the way.
It's interesting, right? Because you said 3,000 years across culture, across geographic location, this story has endured. And there's so much wisdom in the ancient world that we can learn. And I'm excited you're here to share some of it with us today. I am curious, but before we dig into the material, I know you said that the television got kicked down the steps and your dad made you guys read the Odyssey. So obviously, the Odyssey was part of your journey, a spark for you that, as you said, began your path where you're in the world of mythology and Hollywood. I'm wondering, this book, you've written 40 books, and yes, the Odyssey's in theaters now, and Nolan obviously has been working on that for several years, but was it that Nolan decided to make this movie that to where the switch went off in your head and said, I need to write this book about the Odyssey, or was this percolating for a longer period of time?
Remember, I've been going to Greece for good grief, 50 years. In the last 25 to 30 years, I've been teaching there, actually leading tours. And when I take people to Ithaca itself, the home of Penelope, Telemachus, and Odysseus, when I take them to Delphi, the site of the Oracle, the different sites mentioned by Homer, it's not just being there as a tour guide. I am helping people find a way to relate to these sites. And so in the beginning, in the morning, I'll set up the site. We're going to Delphi. What is the deepest question in your life today? Which is a way to deeply identify with this tradition, which went on for 1,500 years, of taking a question. You could be an emperor or a cobbler, and everyone was equal in front of the Delphic Oracle. So I learned how to personalize all of these sites and the book. We would read passages from the book, not in a didactic way, but in a way that provides what I often think of as a map of the soul. The Odyssey is not just an adventure story. It is arguably our first introduction to depth psychology, which is asking what is going on in your soul? What's happening with your spirit? And this is partly inspired by one of my conversations when I was filming Campbell for what became our movie and then my book, The Hero's Journey. And it says, I asked Joe at one point, why do you think people are still talking about your work and not the other mythologists, Mircea Eliade from Romania, I named a few others, Claude Levi-Strauss. The scholars read them, but no one has had the impact as you've had, Joe, on popular culture, one of the biggest influences ever in the movies, but also novelists. And without hesitation, he said, I give all my credit to my female students at Sarah Lawrence. He taught only young women for 38 years. Now, here's the thing that's beautiful, and I find it's helpful even all these years later. Campbell told me that in the first couple of weeks, his young students would inevitably be impressed. Oh, Professor Campbell, you're so brilliant. This is such a wonderful thing. We're learning about Beowulf or the King Arthur legends or the Odyssey. But then Campbell told me within a couple of weeks, they would come up to him one by one in private and say, Professor Campbell, this is wonderful, wonderful stories. But what does it mean to me? What do these stories, ancient stories, and sometimes literature, James Joyce, Thomas Mann, what does it mean to the living of my life now? And Campbell told me that was when he became, my word for it, it comes from the French, an animateur. That is someone, a teacher, maybe a radio host too, like yourself, who can animate, bring soul to teaching. It's not just passing on information. Can you become so passionate that you are bringing the soul and spirit out of the material? And Joe said that was the turning point where he stopped being just an academic scholar or teacher, and he was always looking for the relevant meaning now. In many ways, that's what I've become. When the Hollywood studios come down and say, what does The Matrix really mean? What does Batman mean culturally? What's the story underneath? They're asking a similar story. And these, there are now, people still collect DVDs and they look for the EC, the extra content. You know why? They want meaning. They want more than just entertainment. They want to believe that there are, again, to use that phrase, maps of the soul out there. Great novels, great movies, great journalists. They give us maps. And this is particularly relevant for me, anyway, in my book, The Wisdom of the Odyssey, because I'm trying to distinguish our hero here as not just being lost as if he were in the middle of a New Yorker cartoon, right? Here's the hero leaving Troy, and then he zigzags all across the Mediterranean and the Aegean. And he's supposed to be a great adventurer, a great navigator in general? No, there are lots of cartoons about this. But I look at another way, which I hope is really helpful. He's a lost soul. He lost his soul at war. And if you or the listeners out there have had any contact with veterans, soldiers, or deeply traumatized people, you know, trauma is Greek for wound. It's a Greek word. It's a wound that isn't necessarily healed. People have abuse at home, embezzlement in the workplace. People lose their souls. And I think Homer, who was addressing an aristocratic audience who were very familiar with war and the tremendous devastation of war, where entire cities would be razed to the ground. They wanted to know how to help their returning soldiers. And this is a story not just about complete heroism. This isn't Arnold Schwarzenegger in a toga. No, this is a story about a deeply reflective warrior coming home who's lost. Deeply traumatized, and he can't get home until, and it's a beautiful motif in the story and the movie, by the way, until the wound heals into a scar. James Joyce, remember, he based his Ulysses, often regarded as the most important novel of the 20th century, on Homer's Odyssey. And in one place, he writes in an interview, Odysseus is the world's first complete human being. Good grief. That's an extraordinary statement from a well-educated man. So what does that mean? Here's someone, he's not just your ordinary hero. He thinks. He's considered the first thinking strategist. But he's also wounded in the soul. And I think the book, and this is what I'm trying to do with my 24 life lessons, it's a way for all of us today to deal with often our unmet encounters with our own trauma.
It's interesting the way you're framing Odysseus, because it speaks to me, and your lens is mythology, my lens is clinical psychology. I'm hearing PTSD when we're talking about Odysseus, right?
Yes. I believe it's history's first encounter with description of post-traumatic stress syndrome. And this isn't just a wild guess. I've worked closely for many years now with someone named Dr. Edward Tick, who specializes in veterans and their PTSD. For many years, he used to take the veterans, especially from the Vietnam War, back to the point of trauma, that great Greek word again, and then have rituals and ceremonies at those sites. Let's say somebody in 1969 napalmed a village. Dr. Tick discovered that taking the veteran back there to the site and having a ritual helped first the veteran talk about this. Many of these encounters were never talked about, which of course is, I call it soul rust. You begin to rust from the inside. Now, the last 10 to 15 years, Dr. Tick and many other psychologists, by the way, are taking war veterans to Greece, taking them to the healing centers. This is a little known fact, but the famous Epidaurus, which is where the Dream Temple was, and along with the beautiful amphitheater for theater and the running tracks, there were 300 healing centers in ancient Greece. And the Greek government, a few hundred years later, after Homer, would pay for the soldiers after a major war, let's say Sparta against Athens, to go and spend time in the healing temples to heal the wounds of war. And they're using the Odyssey and the Iliad at times as a map. They say, you are not alone coming back from Iran, Afghanistan. My friend Dr. Tick just took war veterans from Ukraine and Russia and had them come together in Epidaurus. And they read from Homer. This is colossal to me, because it helps break down the thought, oh, this is horrible. No brothers have ever fought against each other. We are the first. We're horrible people. We're just live next door to each other. Look what's happening. I used to host a show on PBS called Global Spirit, and I had guests from all around the world for two or three guests from around the world. One of our shows was on the power of storytelling, and we went down to South Central LA, and we filmed the Crips and the Bloods. We are in the heart of darkness there, to use that metaphor again. And we filmed them because we heard they were using the Iliad as part of their negotiation to come together. And we have one of these really tough gang members saying, he's weeping on camera. This is staggering. He said, man, we thought we were the only brothers who were ever killing each other. And we've had a lot of shame around this. And then they mentioned a local teacher, sociologist, who gave them the Iliad, and they said, and this book, man, this book is helping us heal. So can you see the direction I'm going with this? It's quite extraordinary. And one reason, too, when you see someone who is saying, look, this guy, Odysseus, he's just lost. He's a terrible navigator, and he's a terrible leader because his men keep dying all over the way, and he doesn't know how to handle monsters, and he doesn't know how to handle nymphs. If you back up for a second and say, someone traumatized by 10 years of war is not suddenly going to be healed when the war is over and then just traipse home and declare himself a hero. This is the truest depiction of the deep scar in the soul, the scarred spirit, and what you have to do to get healed. So one more little bit on that. Besides the hero's journey, my team with Dr. Sarah Brown and others, we also filmed Campbell giving his last 10 lectures before he passed away at the age of 83. And one of them was a brief piece on the Odyssey in which he says so vividly, I write about this in chapters 9 through 12, when Odysseus has these encounters with these kaleidoscopic characters that we all know from childhood, the Cyclops, Scylla and Charybdis, the Sirens, the god of the winds. What is going on? Because the book starts with a realistic war and ends with him going to a place we know exists, Ithaca. In between is, in Joe's word, pure dreamland. And that is worth a PhD to study this. What is Homer trying to say? Writing about 2,700 years ago, remember? So it's a few centuries after the so-called Trojan War. What he's saying is what all of you who are working in depth psychology are saying now since Freud, Jung, and Adler, that the healing can't take place in ordinary time and space. Healing needs a temenos, a sacred space, a place to dream. Dream our way into the healing. What did Jung say? We need to dream the myth forward. You remember that famous phrase of his? These middle books are kaleidoscopic scenes about what happens when you are deeply traumatized. And this is written thousands of years before the advent of psychology, which means what in Greek? It's the study of the soul, not just the spirit, not the ego, the soul. And it takes place in dreamland.
So let's stay there for a moment. These monsters, because you're right, it starts out very grounded, and it's spears and it's arrows and all of the things and swords. And then there's a one-eyed giant beast. And then, you know, these female creatures, for lack of a better term, who are beautiful, but their sound will destroy you. What are these mythological creatures? What do you think Homer meant them to be as specific metaphors?
Images from the soul. This is what comes up when we are thrust or dropped. What's one of the great descriptions? Your soul itself will pull you down into the underworld, and suddenly you are face to face with projections. And again, let's be careful with the Jungian language and so on. But what did Goya, the painter, call them? The gods of reason, the monsters of reason. So something like the Cyclops is what? It's an image of devouring. He's devouring. And these are kaleidoscopic scenes in the Nolan film, by the way. It's really enormous. And what is Homer possibly meaning? One of the central themes that is enormously relevant today is what Nolan calls Zeus's law, but with the ancient Greeks call it Xenia, X-E-N-I-A. And it was the code of hospitality. It survives a little bit in the New Testament when they have that phrase, be kind to the first person you meet. It could be an angel in disguise. For the Greeks, there was a code. I think that helped create the entire Greek miracle, the Greek empire. And that is, if someone knocks on your door in the fort, the citadel, the castle, the palace, or even a peasant's hut, you are required by this code to allow that person in, the stranger, the guest, bathe them, feed them, and only the next day, this is very curious, only the next day do you ask, who are you? Where are you from? It's a strange, curious, but beautiful thing. What they're saying is there should be no strings attached. When you travel, you need to feel safe. This was enormously important in ancient times because Greece, if you haven't been there, is enormously mountainous. There are hills and valleys. It's very difficult to drive a chariot across all this. And then you've got 1,000 islands. If you are moving around in a world that's very dangerous, here's a startling thing for your listeners to hear. Before the mid-19th century, roughly half, 50% of travelers never came home again. It took until the 19th century to have safe hotels, safe food. If you left home, there was a good chance you were never coming back, which is why it was a ritual. You left the equivalent of a last will and testament. You said goodbye to your family. You got some kind of counsel from a therapist, a priest, an imam, a rabbi. That's how dangerous it was. In this time, the code of hospitality is enormously important, and we retain a very odd, peculiar, disturbing rendition of that. Xenophobia is a powerful and poisonous aspect in modern times now, which is the hatred of the stranger. For the Greeks, that was a minor, it was xenophilia, the love of the stranger. I'd say the love of a new idea. The love of a new philosophy or religion coming in. You welcome what is new. That's how you learn. And that's how you demystify the stranger. In our time, what happened with us in modern times where we turn this inside out? And now we hate the stranger. So it is one of the powerful threads through the whole Odyssey. He's trying to get home. But while he's been away, our hero, Odysseus, 108 suitors have occupied his house. They are demanding that Penelope, the queen, marry one of them. They're saying, your husband is gone. No one has ever been away this long. Believe us, he's dead. And they begin threats of danger, of murder. They want to murder the son, They want to take over the entire kingdom. Why is this important? Because they have violated Xenia. They have violated the code of hospitality. And in turn, there are inversions of hospitality throughout these middle books, the Dreamlands sequences. So the beautiful gesture of feeding a stranger, someone who's been on the road for a long time, is turned upside down in the Cyclops scene. This is sheer gluttony, and it's cannibalism here. So Homer, as a poet, is also a dramatist, and it's staggering. Every time he brings up something sacred, and I really do mean sacred, the code of hospitality, he has somewhere else in the story, in the poem, a dramatic opposite. It's almost like Jung's ideas of life as a competition between the opposites. The notion that love is really what is pulling Odysseus home. He wants to see his wife and his son, who he left when the boy was an infant. Love is drawing him back, even the love of the land. You know, Henry David Thoreau was also influenced by Homer because the descriptions of nature in the Odyssey are staggering. It's the world's first beautiful nature description. So it's love pulling him home, and the opposite is the constant offers of seduction for him and his men. So there's some beautiful distinction already. Love versus lust is being played out here again and again and again. And I think Homer's audiences 27 some hundred years ago would have recognized all of these. So a final note on that. There were so many versions of the Iliad and the Odyssey in these years, 400 to 500 years after the so-called Trojan War. And what we have now, this is simple for the listeners, audiences, but scholars have wrestled with this for many centuries. These are the versions that worked. The Iliad and the Odyssey would have been told burnished, polished, different versions, slightly changed. You add a character, you lose a character here. You have a plot twist here. That didn't work. It really didn't thrill the audience. So that one was left behind. The one we have now is the one that finally worked in ancient times. So much so that the wandering bards were paid handsomely. Like we would pay Bob Dylan to come to San Francisco, right? Van Morrison, he's here from Ireland. Now you want to pay the bard, the Irish, he's called the Irish bard. You pay him to come and perform. That was the role, the extremely prestigious role of the poets and the bards in ancient times to entertain us, but also, let me wrap up with this for this section, not just to entertain like a spectacle, but instead to remind you of what James Joyce later called what is constant to the human race, which is suffering and the need to heal from suffering. The Odyssey gives us a model for that.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I'm enjoying this conversation so much, Phil. Very clearly, there are things that we today can take from the book. And I know that the subtitle of the book is 24 Life Lessons, so you've clearly thought about that too. Obviously, we don't have time to go through all 24, but we've talked about some important ones. We've talked about xenophilia. We've talked about having a sacred space to heal from trauma. What are some of the other life lessons? Just pick whatever pops into your head of the 24 that would be meaningful for a reader to get out of your book.
Well, let me give you three. It's a magic number in folklore. It's also been regarded now by anthropologists and so on as a way to remember. That's why we have three choruses in modern pop songs. We tend to remember things. You get three wishes, right? So first one, that I deeply identify with, and I've written about this in other books, Once in Future Myths. I used to lecture with Robert Johnson, if you remember, the great Jungian psychologist, on this mentorship. In the first four books, we don't even meet Odysseus until line 2222. It's a very peculiar way to begin the whole story. But what Homer is doing is setting you up to show you what is happening at home, to really press home the point. It's become a dangerous place. Telemachus is now near 20. This is the traditional time when men, young boys, are trying to become men, and they need some kind of soulful relationship with their father. But what if the father's missing? What if he's never been there? What if he boogied off, or he's addicted to work and he's never around? There's a beautiful line in which Penelope turns to her son Telemachus and says, "Go seek thy father." What that means is you've got to go to two of his trusted generals, Menelaus, who's in all the movies, he's in the new one too, but also Nestor. They fought with your father in the war. They might have news. They might be able to tell you for sure he's alive. And then she sends along with him the trusty family council, whose name we still use today, Mentor. Mentor was the family council. Odysseus asked his council to say, "I could be away a long time. I may not even come back. Will you look after my son for me?" This is incredible advice that is still relevant today, because so many young men are growing up without anybody that they admire in terms of a man. All the men are off traipsing around. They're enormous. They've ignored the family in pursuit of money, fame, business, and so on. Now, here's a beautiful thing. Mentor in Greek means mind maker. The mentor is there not to give you information. That's the teacher. Not just to give you career advice. That's the counselor, the career counselor. The mentor looks at the young woman, young girl trying to become a woman, the young man, boy trying to become a man, and says, "I am here to help you make up your own mind." So my advice, one of the very first life lessons in this new book, The Wisdom of the Odyssey, is when you're at a crossroad, when you're in crisis, go seek a mentor. It could be when you're in your teens, but also in a midlife crisis. Later, when some of us are now becoming elders in the world, it's a great time to seek another form of a mentor, someone even older, or, as Campbell taught me, a book. He said he never met James Joyce specifically, but Joyce's work was a mentor crying out from the grave. Books can be mentors. Places can be mentors. So it's a life lesson. There's a beautiful thing here. We get knowledge from here. We get spiritual advice from over there. Who is there to help you say, "Go make up your own mind," and encouraging you? It's very different from the guru tradition, which says this truth, these truths have been around for 9,000 years here in India. Just trust me. The Greek, which became the Western tradition, is very different. So there's one. Go seek a mentor. Another one that's important for me, and it took just a recent reading as I began writing the book. It's in book 9 and 12 when Odysseus finally leaves Calypso and the island and goes off on the raft. He crashes. Poseidon splinters his raft. Odysseus washes up on the shore of this magic land. It is not in reality. Phaeacia, modern Corfu, probably, is a world of wonderment. What happens here qualifies as the world's first science fiction movie or novel. Now take a breath and think about that. There are robots, robot dogs guarding the palace. There are 50 robot servants inside the palace. Homer is telling us that Odysseus, in these next few chapters, is in a dream world, a dreamland. So he comes into the palace. They treat him well, like this Code of Xenia we talked about. And then they bring in a bard, which is part of the healing. It's such a beautiful notion in ancient times. To entertain you, I'm going to have someone sing for you with a lyre. So they bring in this singer, Demodocus, and he begins to sing with Odysseus in disguise because he doesn't want to let on who he is. And he's singing about the Trojan War. This is a staggering moment. Imagine going to someplace and they're beginning to sing about you or me. He's become a legend in his own time. Now here, this is a moment I think then influenced Aristotle, the whole theory of catharsis, which you as a healer would understand more than most people. Catharsis is the release of deep, deep emotion, not just an intellectual understanding. It's a release often in tears. Odysseus, this great warrior, begins to cry. You have to read this thing three times to understand. How could the guy who just conquered Troy be crying now? It's because he's hearing his own song. And then the king says, have we offended you? Have we done something wrong? We fed you. We bathed you. We're entertaining you. And he says, no, you don't understand. I am the man of whom you sing. And then he takes off the robe, the disguise, and he says, my fame is far flung. It's a beautiful alliteration. And now comes my life lesson. He says, let me now tell you what happened in my own words. So it's a gorgeous moment. I think it's one of the moments when the whole story turns. But for modern readers, the way I am saying this is something you might even do in one of your sessions. He says, I'm writing my life lesson. If you do not find a way to tell your own story, someone else will tell it for you and you won't like it. It could be your parents. It could be your spouse. It could be your boss. Culture will jump into that vacuum. So find a way in words and stories and mosaics, in a quilt, whatever it takes. Learn to seize. It's kind of the seize the day, but it's seize the story. Seize the story before someone else tells it for you. This is a way. What's that old line by Thurber? I don't know what I think until I read what I have to say. And this is in Homer. He doesn't know what he thinks about his own life until he begins to tell the story. Dame Edith Hall from London has an astounding insight here in which she says, arguably, this is the first moment of human consciousness in Western literature. It's the first moment when someone realizes, I'm aware. Why? Because you are hearing your story next to someone else's. And then you begin to tell it yourself. This takes my breath away. And already I'm getting mail on this. I've taught this for years and years, and people will continue to write me for years. A woman will say, I had to take my story back from my husband. A guy will say, my father has always been the one who told my story. And then finally, I'll make this one shorter. At the very end of the book, which is changed in the movie with Nolan, we can talk about that later. In the beautiful poetry of the book, Odysseus comes home, but again, because it's so dangerous to come into a house where there are 108 men who want to kill you. 108 is a very mythical number, by the way. It's magic in Hindu mythology, Buddhist mythology, Australian Aborigine mythology, sometimes in Native American mythology. 108 always refers to the turning of an epic, an enormous sea change in culture. So Homer did not make up this number arbitrarily. It's signaling something vast is changing. Odysseus comes back. There's a series of tests between him and his wife. They're erotic. They're cute. They're fun. But they're tests, which is really important. Are you, my dear husband, are you, dear wife, have you been faithful to me? Who are you? Are you an imposter? I haven't seen you for 20 years. You sure look different, right? Finally, they recognize each other. They go to bed, and it's so beautiful in the different translations. One is, and they shared their delight in love together. It's very simple, but here's the point I turn into a life lesson. Penelope, the queen, turns to her husband and says in this wonderful, almost Victorian rhythm, come tell me of thine ordeals, for my heart can take it. She is saying what everybody, people in relationships, but also old friends say, okay, I haven't seen you for a while. Tell me what's really important. What is happening to you? I can take it. I can take it. And then, so Odysseus is happy to tell his stories like most men are, right? Okay, I'm glad you're interested. Here's this next moment qualifies Homer as being the world's first feminist writer. because Odysseus now turns to his wife and says, and now you tell me, sweetheart, what did you have to endure here while I was gone? What was it like for you to deal with these monsters who are eating us out of house and home? What was it like for you to raise our son alone? Do you realize the immensity of this? This is a husband and wife who haven't seen each other for years. They make love, but then they tell stories to each other and they listen. I think male authors forgot this for about 2,000 years afterwards. So for me, it's a life lesson. You've been separated from your spouse, a loved one. Have you asked them what they're actually going through? What's your story? What happened? And now, in turn, are you listening? It's a beautiful moment. And I think it's a way that Homer, this great, great poet, is summing up a very violent story. And he's giving us a vision of what can heal the soul after someone has been deeply traumatized.
This is great stuff. So mentor, get a mentor, tell your story before someone else does. Listen, there's 21 other ones we haven't even touched on, which is remarkable to me. I do want to have you put your archaeologist hat on here for a second, Phil, because I'm fascinated. You mentioned the 108 as showing up in Hindu cultures, ancient Hindu cultures, Native American culture, of which there was no Native American culture when Homer would have written this. So from a knowledge acquisition standpoint, if this is a mystical number that is in all of these different religious traditions and cultural traditions all around the world, when do you think Homer came by that knowledge and how?
There is a theory that I'm ascribing to, and I saw just last night that there was a scholar from India who has this new talk out right now in which he is, let's say, exploring or speculating, a beautiful verb, to speculate, which means to hold a mirror up to something. That's what speculate means. And he's saying, we think that in Homer, or I call him the poet known as Homer, as he's wandering from his home in what was or what is now the west coast of Turkey, wandering north to Troy. It would take one day by horse, by the way, from where Homer was raised, up to the ruins of Troy, which were already ruins for 500 years when Homer was growing up. And then to go across, I'm thinking he heard all these stories from sailors, sailors' yarns, as they used to call them. He begins to go across the Peloponnese, wandering around Greece. There is a theory that Greek and Indian scholars were crisscrossing right up to the time of Alexander the Great, a few hundred years later. And there's a very good chance that Homer encountered one of these wandering sadhus, they would have called them, wandering pilgrim scholars, who were searching for wisdom. And they heard there were some great, great teachers all the way over there in Greece. Because this number 108 is not arbitrary. It's a deeply sacred number. And by the way, also 108 beads in a rosary, 108 threads in a baseball. It goes on. It's fun. We have to have fun with these things too. So now there's this theory that it wasn't just traders and soldiers who left Greece. There were wandering scholars from this point on, from Hippocrates to Herodotus, the scholars, they went in search of, and I love this as someone who has traveled the world. You would travel for months to meet one person you heard about who's very wise in the west coast of Turkey, northern Africa. You might travel for months to find one manuscript. There's one copy of a manuscript, which is a way to begin to think about the Greek miracle. The curiosity there in ancient times was so intense, so all-encompassing, that travelers went in search of knowledge. And in this way, I believe that the part of the spiritual depths of the Odyssey came from Homer, or let's say the poet known as Homer, and an encounter with wandering Indian sages. It's a beautiful thought. It's a way to think about how could one poet, maybe two, there are these theories, maybe one poet for the Iliad, one for the Odyssey. It's an accumulation of human wisdom, which is why I call this the wisdom of the Odyssey. These are discoveries at the depths of great philosophers, poets, anthropologists, psychologists. You wrap them all together. who was it? Shakespeare was later described as the poet of medieval Europe, and vice versa. I like to think of Homer as the Shakespeare from antiquity, or the Emily Dickinson of antiquity. How can you plumb the depths of the soul like this and live to tell about it?
This has been such a fascinating conversation, Phil. I did want to spend a little time talking about the current movie. You know, Hollywood has always been fascinated with Greek mythology. My Greek mythology introduction, also a young boy in Detroit, my dad took me to see Clash of the Titans. I believe it was 1980, and I'm hooked. There have been a lot of movies made, a lot of odysseys made. The latest Odyssey, Nolan's Odyssey, is controversial for a lot of reasons. But in terms of source material, how true is it to what Homer wrote?
All right. Spoiler alert. So if your listeners haven't seen the movie yet, you might want to click off now and come back later, listen to the rest later. So a couple of things that are important. This is fair game. Nolan himself recently has said, I don't take all the critics too seriously. Remember, I dealt with this for 10 years with Batman, with Interstellar, with Inception. When you go vast like this in public, you're used to this. So he knows that there will be questions. My concern here is his version close to the soul of the story, the wisdom of Homer's contribution? It's more than a book. This is a tremendous contribution to the cultural conversation that's going on for 3,000 years. So it's a spectacle. That's first. There are images in this movie, like the Trojan horse, half buried in the sea, half in the sand, that they have to pull by rollers up to the famous windy walls of Troy. That's staggering. You will dream about some of these images. The Siege of Troy. A war, if you can say a war has never been filmed so beautifully. Now, isn't that an oxymoron, right? A wonderful scene with Odysseus in disguise coming home dressed as a beggar, and he's seated outside of the looming room, the room where Penelope is at her loom working on the shroud for her father-in-law. And between the two, it's breathtaking in its beauty. They haven't seen each other for 20 years. It's always been believed there's a hint that they know who each other are. It's beautifully filmed. But in the end, especially the ending, I have questions about what is the challenge for a filmmaker. If you try to film every scene, every character, every version, interpretation, this is a 9-hour movie. So obviously you can't do it. A 3-hour movie is already the most expensive movie of our time. $250 million for the budget, $250 for the promotion, the marketing. In Hollywood terms, that means $3 for every dollar you spend. This movie has to gross $1.5 billion just to break even. So what do? You have to make it as wide as possible to appeal not just to scholars who can actually read in Greek what Homer was really saying. You can't just do this for educated psychologists like yourself or people who know Greece. You have to go wide. There isn't enough money otherwise. And that means you have to make compromises. So there are conflations that go along. I'll give you a couple of brief examples here. And then the most important wrestling with this is the ending. When Odysseus washes up on shore of the island with Calypso, she begins to feed him lotus. And then the inference here is that she has captured him with the lotus, which is a kind of early opium. Think of it as a kind of opium, opiate. So he's eating it, and he goes into this long reverie, and he doesn't even remember who he is, doesn't remember his wife, his family. He doesn't remember the war. And so what Christopher Nolan is doing is conflating the later chapter with the lotus eaters with the storytelling sequence I just alluded to on the island of Phaeacia, conflating all of that into this one character, Charlize Theron, the actress who plays Calypso. And she's trying to get him to tell his story, almost like a therapist. So you might identify with this. The problem is, in the book and cultural understanding is, This is a very erotic relationship. It has been. There's nothing wrong with that. Soldiers returning from war, guess what? There was a lot of erotic encounters on the way home. This is human history, for goodness sakes. We can't be prudes about this. So what happens begins there at the very beginning of the movie, continues. There was also, and remember, her one of the most touching points in the book is still speaks to us. The goddess says, why are you mooning? Why are you looking out to sea all the time? What are you thinking about? I will make love to you every day for the rest of eternity. I am beautiful. I will give you lotus to eat. What's wrong with all that? Right? And Odysseus turns back and says, you are beautiful. You are a goddess. This has been wondrous with you, but you're not Penelope. Good grief. What a response, right? This is early depth psychology. He's saying this is eroticism. It's desire. It ain't love. And so he's haunted to go home. But Nolan loses, I'm sorry, with all due respect, there is no eroticism here. There's no promise of love. It's mostly therapeutic because Nolan's biggest theme in this is guilt, which isn't in the original Odyssey. What he wants us to believe is that all of Odysseus's grief and all the mistakes he makes on the way home are because he feels guilty about bringing the Trojan horse into Troy, which is a metaphor, and it's so recognizable. I know what he's doing as a screenwriter, as a director. The Trojan horse is one of those archetypes, what they actually call mythologems, like King Arthur's Excalibur. You see the image, you don't have to talk about it. We know immediately what it is, right? But in this version, in Nolan's Odyssey, he's trying to make a case that will go through for 3 hours that Odysseus is haunted because he persuaded the Trojans to take the Trojan horse in, and then the slaughter began. But I'm sorry, he's a warrior. They have been fighting for 10 years. He is trying to win a war. Generals do not feel guilt like that. So you have to be able to buy into that metaphor that all the mistakes he makes, including losing his crew, taking 10 years to get home, all of it is due to guilt. So it's the plot line. And if you're making a movie like this, you have to determine one thread that's instantly recognizable to people the world over. And on some levels, it works if you think of the movie as spectacle. And frankly, most people will. 9 out of 10 viewers, they say, take me away. Take me on a ride. This, especially if you watch it in IMAX, it's staggering. You feel like you've been in a 3-hour dreamland movie, okay? But there are some values in here that have changed, which leads up to this, and I'll wrap with this. In the ending, Homer is saying, I think something brand new to the human story, the human condition, and it's been lost for millennia. Homer and the resolution with the lovers, Odysseus and Penelope coming together, and this is why there have been thousands of paintings, murals, mosaics, even on the floors of Pompeii, the reunion of the two lovers. It's one of the most famous moments in cultural history, not literal history. But here, there's no resolution. The two don't come together. Instead, Nolan's Odyssey has Odysseus coming home and single-handedly, with no help from anybody else, kill the 108 suitors. This is not in the book. This is right out of an American Western movie from the 1950s. In the poem, Odysseus fights with his son, with two friends who've been loyal to him all these years, and the goddess Athena. Only that way, with the divine help, with his son, shoulder to shoulder, can he beat the 108. So is this just incidental? No. There is a slippage at the end that I find I'm still reeling over it. They're now turning Matt Damon as Odysseus into a Marvel comic character. He single-handedly wields a sword and fights off 108 soldiers. Are you kidding me? This is no longer Greek poetry. This is right out of the Marvel comics. But it's also part of American mythology. We don't need anybody else. It's me against the world. And so in the end, with this a little kind of lap dissolve, as they call them, now Odysseus is lying in the arms of his wife, Penelope, and he's got arrows in his back like he's Saint Sebastian. Where did that come from? So now the hero is a martyr. This is a layer. This is layered on. This is not in the original story. It's not in the story that's been repeated for 2,700 years. So what's it in service of? You love thinking in depth, right? I do too with these movies. So what happens at the end is right out of, again, the way that American Westerns ended in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Odysseus suddenly, with no resolution, no real reunion, he leaves home immediately. And the last shot is on a pier as he's leaving on a boat. They're handing the crown over to Tom Holland, playing Telemachus, who's there smiling. Okay, now I'm king. It's a kind of a Spider-Man moment. It's peculiar, if you know these. And so there is this prophecy that he's got to leave home someday and go out. And it's a mysterious message, which is beside the point right now. What happens effectively is what happens with John Wayne at the end of The Searchers, often regarded as the greatest American Western. John Wayne plays the hero. John Ford directs. You know what The Searchers is based on? Homer's Odyssey. The greatest Western movie is pulled right out of the Odyssey. And the last shot, maybe it's unconscious, but the last shot Nolan's Odyssey is an echo of John Ford's The Searchers, where the farmers are saying, stay with us, stay with us. You brought back Natalie Wood. You brought back the girl who was captured by the Comanches. We love you. You can stay with us. He turns his back. And the last shot of John Wayne is walking through the door frame into the sunset, jumps on his horse, and rides away. It is one of the archetypal moments in all of American movies. And many foreigners think of Americans like that, the lone wolf hero. That is how Nolan's Odyssey ends. There is no payoff of love making, really, in any depth, no emotion there. Instead, the hero goes. So this is a signature move for the year 2026, when the message America is giving to the rest of the world is, we don't need you. We can go it alone. That's why it's at the heart, I think, of the combustible discussion over the movie. What's it? Jung himself once said, never say just a symbol. That really comes to life here. These are symbolic scenes, symbolic movements. The rest of the world is looking at this movie as very differently than the average audience in Topeka, Kansas, or Wayne, Michigan, where I grew up. And in that way, it's ingenious. Christopher Nolan, in all of his unquestionable genius, is giving us a story that goes wide as possible, and it reinforces the American mythology. And I use that word advisedly, the American myth of individualism.
Phil, this has been such a great conversation. This might be my longest episode ever, so congrats for that. I love everything we've talked about. I'm going to have you back on again. We've got a lot more to talk about. But as you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question. And that is, what is your biggest helping? That one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
Well, thank you. That is what I thought about virtually every day while I was writing this book, The Wisdom of the Odyssey. It is a life guide. It's a map of the soul. It can help us now. It can help us assuage the pain that we are the only ones whose heart has been broken. It helps us. I want people who have been wounded, traumatized, troubled, isolated. American isolationism, in every sense of that phrase, is upon us. The Odyssey can help. But what I want you to do, as an audience, as listeners, as moviegoers, movie lovers, go deeper. like Rilke told the young poet who wasn't getting published, the reason nobody publishes are you haven't gone deep enough. So for those of you who have felt your heart palpitate watching the movie, or you're excited looking at the trailer, trust those movements in your heart and soul. Turn to a book like mine, which is going for the wisdom. What can we learn here? How can we be better human beings? Ask what is wise, really, about every encounter. What is the hidden meaning in your friendships, your relationships at work? Ask and then listen.
Well said. The book is The Wisdom of the Odyssey, 24 Life Lessons from Homer's Epic. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. But Phil, if people have loved the conversation, why wouldn't they have? And they want to learn more about you, where can they go on the internet to find out about you and all the good things you're doing?
Oh, please, philcusino.com. On there, you can see my lecture schedule, the book appearances for the movie, but also information about my tours, because I'm leading a tour in September and another one next spring in the footsteps of Odysseus and Penelope. I've got tours coming up to Ireland, to Costa Rica, probably Paris. Please come and join us, because you know what we do? We have these adventures, and then good grief, we actually talk about them. We ask and we listen to each other. I think that's the formula for healing the planet.
Well said. Well said. Well, we'll have links to all of that in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. What a great conversation.
Thank you. You're adding, Dr. Richard, to this, the long conversation, by encouraging us to talk and to listen to each other. So bravo. Thank you.
Thank you. And to each and every one of you who took time out of your day, thank you as well. If you like what you heard, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, and I imagine Homer would have something to say about this, go out there and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.